Coming up on Boston Public Radio, it's Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, joining us for his monthly visit. Ask the mayor. He'll take your questions and ours.
Those who travel the fine art circuit might know him for his photography. Museum of Science geeks know him as the voice behind the New England capsule film. And Trekkies, you know him as Spock. That's right, Leonard Nimoy joins us to talk about his upcoming appearances with the Boston Pops. From there, Emily Rooney reveals her Achilles heel. It's true, she has one. And the hint is, she goes nuclear on herself. And we wrap up with our Friday news quiz. It's no holds barred as two Shakespeare experts duel one another for news quiz supremacy. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Marjorie Egan. He is Jared Bowen, arts editor for WGBH. Jim Browdy is on vacation listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. And here with us in Studio 3, as he is once a month, is Mayor Marty Walsh. He'll be taking our questions and yours. Here's the phone number, 877-301-8970. You can also send an email to bpr@wgbh.org. Mayor Walsh, thank you very much for coming here. Great to see you. You know, I said before we went on the air, and this is really true, you know, I read the papers every day, watch the news every day. If I had your job, I would be a total basket case. There's so many things to deal with.
Every day.
Yeah, well, let's start with the schools. You know, a very uplifting headline today on the front page of the Boston Globe, Hub Schools in Disarray. It's talking about complete disarray. The Court Street, which is where the administration is, all the supervisors and the higher-ups, the bureaucrats, the school system, everybody's vying for power in the central office. That's a quote. The food service program is in disarray, wasting millions of dollars. You've got a superintendent search going on. People are listening. They're calling in about the schools. How are you going to fix these schools, Marty Walsh? I mean, there seems to be a sense, and this is the previous administration, Carol Johnson, the former superintendent, Mayor Menino is the former mayor, but there seems to be huge and rampant dissatisfaction with the schools.
Well, this was a big issue in the campaign for mayor all last year. We were campaigning. I think almost every candidate spoke a lot about revamping our schools. And this study that's reported in the Boston Globe today is reported, was a study done by the school department to see where the faults were, where the problems were. And it's come out today, and you can read them and see that there's some concerns in the school system. A lot of those, we've been beginning to address a lot of the concerns that are in that report. Certainly working towards a human capital program where we're going to raise $25 million from private foundations. We're hiring 1,000 new teachers in the Boston Public School System for the next school year. We started the process of hiring teachers earlier last year. The process was to hire them later as the year went on. You'd wait till the school year to end. We're rehiring them now. We're hiring new teachers now. We're changing the culture in on Court Street. Somebody asked me the question today about a power grab, and I said, there'll be no power grab. We're going to make sure that we improve and make the school systems in Boston the best schools we can have in the country. There's still a lot of work to be done. We're talking about, you know, we launched a program last week of an advisory committee to bring in early pre-K education here in the city of Boston by 2018, have universal pre-K. That's a big step in improving our schools. We've launched and working on reforming our high schools. We're working on schools like Madison Park right now, Votech School, that's gone through three leadership changes in the last 3 years. And
massive disarray here by Madison Park.
I mean, you just constantly hear, and a lot of it is lack of leadership in some of those schools. And there's some great leaders in the schools and some great leaders that have done some great things turning our schools around. The report is not a good report. Our schools are better than the report is saying right now. And we have John McDonough has made some big changes.
He's the acting superintendent.
Acting superintendent. And, you know, certainly, I think Monday or Tuesday, the paper talked about the food service. I'm not happy about that.
Yeah.
We are going to make changes
losing
there.
Losing $21 million, I think it was.
I'm not even concerned. I mean, I'm concerned about losing money, but it's the fact that even providing good food to our kids, we're not even doing that in some cases. So we're revamping that whole department. You know, people are seeing a lot of change here in the schools department, and there's going to be more change. And what that change means, if you're not willing to improve the quality of our schools and work together and think you're going to work in a silo, you won't be working for the school. You won't be working for the city of Boston.
So another issue that's been hitting headlines this week is the issue of taxis versus Uber and now the other services that are springing up. And this was the scene actually outside the Uber headquarters in downtown Boston yesterday.
What are you protesting for?
It's a Uber, Hackney, everything. You see that Hackney? No more Hackney because they steal our job.
So this, of course, was a protest because the taxi industry is saying it's really being hurt at this point and revenue is down substantially, even by a third by their accounts, because people are using these easier app services like Lyft and Uber to take rides. And the issue is that these Uber and other car services aren't as regulated as the taxi industry. So they're imploring you to have some further regulation. How are you looking at that at this point?
Well, we're looking at this whole transportation system. When I talk about transportation, I'm talking car transportation system. We're putting people in the room, key stakeholders in the room. The taxi industry's had problems in Boston over the last couple of years. There was a terrible report a few years ago. I don't think any changes made to make it a better system. So we're gonna fix that. I think that there has to be regulations. Uber is a very popular service. We have to look at how do we regulate that industry to some degree. They claim there's some regulations there, but we don't have any jurisdiction over it. When I say we, the city.
Well, who does regulate the taxi industry?
The city regulates the taxi industry. Uber's kind of.
But that's a dispute too, right? That the Hackney division is not done a very good job regulating the taxi industry.
And the way they do it, New York, the way New York does it, New York has a Hackney division. But they have 15,000, I think it's maybe 30,000 yellow cabs in the city of Boston, in New York. We have about 1,500 to 2,000 cabs in Boston. But if you look at all the transportation system, whether it's Uber and other, there's other companies out there as well that does transportation. We're looking at how do we create a Hackney transportation division and where does that fit within city government? Does it fit separately and independent? Does it fit with the police department? Does it fit in the transportation department? And those changes will be made. I think for the taxi industry, too, they have to change. I mean, you have a service like Uber. I mean, I hear nothing. We have concerns about Uber, but as far as the service they provide, you hear nothing but positives. Every person, I think, under the age of 30 years old in the city of Boston has the app and they download it and they use Uber. And so it's a popular mode of transportation, but we have to make sure it's a safe mode of transportation.
Well, I wonder if it's even possible to have a level playing field at this point. I mean, they talk about how the onus is on the taxi drivers to maintain their vehicles, and you have a vastly different experience. I've taken Uber any number of times. It's clean cars. You can watch the app. You know immediately when they're going to show up. The driver's picture shows up, so you know the whole safety element. And by and large, it's very difficult to take cabs in this city because they, despite the regulations that were supposed to come, no more talking on your cell phone, cleaning the cabs, it's still not the case. It's not an enjoyable experience often to take a cab in the city of Boston. Yeah,
and part of the cab's problem is that the drivers, a lot of them aren't the owner of the medallion. So it's not their vested interest necessarily. And so that's an issue as well. You have four or five people that own the majority of the medallions in the city of Boston. I'm not opposed to that, clearly. But you know, you have employers who their drivers are employees, and I think with Uber you have somebody who actually is the owner of the vehicle. We're going to look and act quickly on this because the report that was done in the city, as I said, I think it was 18, 19 months ago on the cabs, hasn't been touched. I mean,
The Boston Globe Spotlight series that focused in on Boston Cab, and what they detailed, among other things, was basically these drivers making almost no money.
Yeah.
They're having to pay to get their keys in the morning. The guy that owns Boston Cab is a multi millionaire who's made an awful lot of money. These cab drivers, the cabs are not insured, so if you get injured seriously, they are insured. They're insured, I think, $20,000 for liability, which is really low compared to drivers or compared to the livery drivers or even compared to bicycle messengers.
Yeah.
So I think they're getting away with bad stuff.
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do there. I've had conversations with Police Commissioner Evans. I've had conversations with Jim Galluli, who's the department head at the transportation department. We have a person in our office now that we assigned to this last week. This is before the protest, to say, okay, let's pull all the parties together. Let's get something happening here because, God forbid, I don't want something to happen that's going to be bad. I mean, people can protest on different modes of transportation if they want, but we're going to come up with a better system here in the city.
Well, you want to take some phone calls? I'll give the number again, 877. Can you see the phone calls here?
Yes, I can.
Okay, 877-301-8970. The mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, will be with us until 1 o'clock if you want to call in or email, and we'll stop talking for a little bit so you guys can. You want to take a call,
yeah,
Mr. Mayor?
Let's get Kathy from Rosendale on because she's called in before we started.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Mayor Wells.
Hi, Kathy.
I am a Boston Public School parent, and I'm calling to ask what you are doing as the champion of the Boston Public Schools to advocate to limit the charter. I believe that the charter cap should not be lifted because I'm concerned we're going to have a two-tier school system, and I want to know that BPS is fully funded.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, first of all, the legislature in the House last week voted to lift the charter cap, and it's going over to the Senate now. I don't view the charter schools as something that's going to put us out of business in Boston. I'm focused on making sure that our school system is the best school system in urban America. I think that we can learn from the charter schools, and I think charter schools have learned from us. This year, we also worked with the legislature to get some reimbursements back to the city of Boston to level us off a little bit. We're able to secure some money, which is helpful. But I agree with you in the sense of we need to make sure that we get our fair share of money here to the city. The budget for the school department is nearly $1 billion, $973 million this year. The reimbursement from the state's portion of that's about 13% of our budget. So the vast majority of our budget, 87%, is paid for through our general fund, through our taxes that we receive from real estate tax and a little bit of local aid. So we do have some work to do on revamping as far as how do we get better, more money into the system. But I don't view charter schools as something that's going to put us out of business. The only thing that's going to put public education out of business is public education. And we have to make changes, and we have made some of those changes, and we're going to continue to make those changes. I've visited many schools in the city of Boston since I've been elected, and we have some very committed teachers, and oftentimes teachers get criticized for the problem in the system. It's not a teacher problem. The administrators, it's not an administrator problem. It's not a parent problem. It's a little bit of everybody, and we have to have a little better coalition going on around education, around young people. The schools that parents are involved with and engaged in, the schools are top schools. Schools where the parents aren't as engaged, you can see they're not there. Same for teachers and administrators. So we have to bring pride back into our system. That's part of the issue. We have great kids in our system. We just got to continue to give them the services they need and the education they deserve.
Now, as people know, John McDonough, the interim superintendent, has been getting rave reviews from a lot of parents and a lot of politicians as well who's watched him. But he's not the permanent superintendent. He doesn't want to be the permanent superintendent. Last night, Mayor Walsh, on Greater Boston with Emily Rooney, someone whose voice will be very familiar to you was on there, and Emily asked him about whether he'd like to become the superintendent of schools. Let's hear that clip.
Look, I'd love to be superintendent and on the one hand, because I really think that we can make this system work and deliver quality education to every child, but it takes strong leadership to do that. But by the same token, I want to respect this mayor's right to pick the person that he wants because, you know, that mayor's got to have absolute trust in that superintendent. They've got to be on the same page, and there are plenty of people out there.
Okay, that, of course, is the voice of John Conley.
Yes,
I ran against you from mayor. Mr. Schools, he was the big schools guy.
Yep.
Is he a guy you consider?
Last time I was on, I think I was on this station, I made a comment about that, and it went viral.
We're hoping to do that again, Mr. Mayor. We want to go viral.
I've spoken to John about the school issue since the campaign, since I've been mayor of Boston, and we had a good laugh about it, and John expressed he would not be interested in being the superintendent. I think in his heart he would be a great superintendent of a school system. I think coming into Boston, Boston's a big lift for going from not being a superintendent to being superintendent of Boston, even for John or for anybody that have great credentials around education. It's a big lift because you're talking about a big system. But John had some great ideas in the campaign, and John is passionate about education, as I am, and you know, some of his ideas we're talking about. I think having John as an advocate out there, his voice out there talking about the schools, is good for us because it raises the bar to make sure we stick to the reforms we talk about.
Go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
How about Rena in South Boston?
Hi, Mr. Mayor. My name is Rena.
Oh, sorry, Rena.
That's okay. I'll start by saying, truthfully, I did not vote for you. And I think I speak for a lot of the people who didn't vote for you, that our issue really is the schools. And I'm happy to bring this conversation back to the schools, because I think it really is important. And I feel like I'm a parent, and I just got my son's advanced work assignment, and he's assigned to a school in Hyde Park, which I don't need to talk to you about why he's being assigned a school in Hyde Park, and we live in South Boston. But, you know, I have a choice. I don't have to send him to the Boston Public Schools. But if I didn't have a choice, and if that was my family's only hope, was to send him to Hyde Park, it's ridiculous. And I feel like the inaction on schools is an assault on community. And now the school assignments are coming out. Another crop of families is moving to Milton from South Boston. Another crop of families is disappointed with the communication, with the whole thing. And the whole, I mean, I'm just going to say it, poop storm that is the Boston Public Schools, because it's so dodgy. And I know there are good news stories. I saw you at the Henderson event. There are lots of good news stories. But the whole thing, I'm like an Ivy League educated person. I can't make heads or tails out of the school choice. And it's ridiculous. If I didn't speak English, if I was, you know, had some, you know, other incapacity,
I
would be out of luck.
I think we got it. You're very, very unhappy.
I'm very unhappy.
Okay, let them hear.
I'm committed to being in the city.
Yep.
And I feel like having the schools be as bad as they are is an assault on community.
Let the mayor jump in. Thank you for the call.
I think in some cases the schools aren't as bad as everyone makes out to be. I think if parents who moved to Milton and moved to Braintree stayed in the city of Boston, invested in the school system, you would see a school system that would turn around. By the way, I've been in office for 5 months. So the school assignment plan that is currently in existence was voted under the last administration, the last city council, the last mayor. Since I've been over, we've worked on a budget. We've had to cut some money out of our budget. We've made some changes in the transportation system. We're also looking at our facilities in the city of Boston. We'll put together advisory council on having early childhood education earlier in for universal pre-K by the year 2018. I'm sitting down with the school department as far as leadership in schools around the city of Boston. One of the things I did in this year's budget, I put $1 million in to do a study of all the school buildings. I think one of the reasons why your child was sent over to Hyde Park is probably that the capacity of having enough space in Southie is not there. And that's a big problem. And the city hasn't, in the last 40 years, hasn't put the right action plan in place to be able to deal with the population shifts. And we're gonna do that. We're gonna build new schools in the city of Boston, and we're gonna create schools where the young folks are and where the population is. There's a lot of changes that have to be made. I wouldn't necessarily call our schools a disaster because there's a lot of young people, a lot of families that have invested in our schools. I have a friend of mine that didn't get the school she preferred, which is the Henderson, where she wanted to go. She got a different school, which is closer to our house. And what we need to do is make sure parents take an opportunity to send their kids to the school and get active in the school. So there's a lot we have to do, but there's also a lot that we have to do as a public as well. And we're going to make those changes. And I apologize for your frustration there. But I think by families moving out of the city of Boston is not the answer, because I'll tell you, there are problems in those school districts outside of Boston as well.
Yes, there are, actually.
Okay, what we're also taking emails to bpr@wgbh.org. We have one from Jerry, who is writing about the casino issues, mainly from a business perspective, he says. And he says, people generally have just so much disposable income, and what goes into the casino coffers presumably comes from other coffers, including thousands of small businesses like lottery points of sale. Do you share those concerns? Do you support the rights of Massachusetts citizens to vote to repeal the casino legislation? How will you vote?
Well, first of all, I support the voter has the right to vote. That's why we have the initiative petition. That question now, I believe, is in front of the court. It hasn't been ruled on if that ballot question will go on the ballot yet. I've been fighting as mayor of the city of Boston to ensure that people of East Boston and Charlestown have the right to a vote for those two proposals in their communities. It's been pretty well documented in the press. And that, you know, I've supported casinos as a legislator, but I support the process. And the process, the way it's laid out, is that people have the right to vote. And so I feel people should have the right to vote whether or not a casino goes in their community. Secondly, if this issue does go to the ballot, it's going to be up to the voters. And if the voters repeal the casino law, it's repealed, and you go by the will of the voter.
Well, he also, and this is something you've been addressing, the host communities and being adjacent to them. He also asks, wherever casinos are located, predatory businesses like pawn shops and payday loans proliferate. Again, this is from this email. How will these be addressed proactively?
I mean, I think it depends on where the casinos are located. I think that, there's zoning certainly in those cities and towns surrounding the casinos. For example, in Boston, if pawn shop was going to exist in Boston, there's a process they'd have to go through. I'm not necessarily concerned about that issue in neighborhoods. I don't see a big something like that happening. Because I'll tell you right now, with both proposals, the Wynn and Mohegan Sun, they're looking for high-end shops. They want to make this an upscale casino. So they're not looking to have a slot parlor in the middle of a neighborhood. They're actually looking for high end. So I think that the pawn shops and those other places will be discouraged around there. But, casinos bring challenges to a community. And I think that a lot of people right now in a lot of parts of the state are looking at what the challenges might be that come with a casino.
Mr. Mayor, can I ask you a question about secure communities? You've said that you want to pull out of secure communities, and people don't know that's the program. It started in Boston in 2006 and expanded nationally after that, 2008, I think. And the idea is it identifies illegal immigrants who've been arrested and allows the Department of Homeland Security to access their fingerprints taken by the local cops, and then the feds can look at those fingerprints to see if there's any immigration information or any other things on databases involving their immigration. You know that Mayor Curtatone over in Somerville, he just signed this executive order which would bar police from holding people solely to allow federal agents to pick them up for suspected immigration violations. Could you and would you want to do that in Boston, just sign an executive order? Could you and would you?
No, we can't. I don't believe we can. Our law department's looking at that right now. But let me just talk a little bit about secured communities. The intent behind secure communities is to, what I think, is get undocumented immigrants that get arrested for crimes and have them thrown out of the country and sent back to their homeland.
Right.
What the concern in the immigrant community is that people are getting pulled over for having their taillight out, and they're being detained and put into a lockdown and held there and deported for that reason. Now, I know there are listeners out there that think that every undocumented immigrant should be thrown out of the country.
Yep.
People feel that way. We have a problem with immigration in this country. We need to make sure that we do a better job, and the Congress and the Senate have to come up with comprehensive immigration reform. Because it's not a Democrat issue, it's not a Republican, even though people say, it's Democrats, it's not the Democrats, it's both sides. Because some of the largest influx of undocumented immigrants in this country happened under George Bush.
Right.
And another part of our history when a large portion of undocumented immigrants came into the country was under Ronald Reagan. So I think we have to look at this issue, and the federal government has to address this issue once and for all. Because the police officers in Boston, or Somerville for that matter, or wherever you are, their job is not enforcing federal law. Their job is protecting the streets of their cities and making sure that we get serious criminals off the street. Now, if somebody who is undocumented gets arrested for a serious crime, that person should be sent back. If somebody gets pulled over on the side of the road and you happen to be in the car and you're undocumented, I don't necessarily think it's not the Boston police's job to take that person out of the car, detain them, send them to immigration, send them back to the country. And I think that, I think people are getting very hot on this issue, but this issue really belongs in Washington. And one of the issues that Washington has to resolve and stop talking about is this issue around undocumented immigrants.
I just want to be clear, though. If you could do something as the mayor, as an executive, would you do something?
I mean, I don't know how big of a problem it is in Boston because I don't think our police department are necessarily sending people that aren't causing crimes. I think secure communities needs to be severely changed.
Okay.
I'll be honest with you on that. And if I could do it, I will do it. What Mayor Curtatone spoke about and gotten some hot water over, this is an issue. I mean, it's an issue.
And people get very upset.
And we have to deal with it. And again, it's not the Boston Police Department's job to be running around the streets finding out who's documented, who's not documented in the immigrant community. A lot of immigrants came to this country hardworking as citizens, and we don't need profiling. And I was at a forum the other night where I had a young woman from East Boston that said to me that there are immigrants in East Boston, undocumented, concerned about reporting domestic violence because they think they're going to be thrown out of the country.
So if you feel this way and you're not sure it's as much of an issue in Boston, why not join Mayor Curtatone and send a message?
Before Mayor Curtatone made his announcement the other day, we've already begun looking at it. It's something that I stated very early in my administration. I actually stated during the campaign.
Yeah.
And we also have legislation. We don't. The legislators, that's a slip there.
You used to be there.
And there's legislation, the Trust Act. And if the legislature would pass that Trust Act, that would take care of a lot of problems.
Okay. So if you could do something, you might do something.
I want to do something. Okay. Let's put it that way.
We're going to take a break, but don't go anywhere because Marty Walsh is going to be with us until the top of the hour. He is here till 1 o'clock for your calls and our questions and your questions and everybody's questions. 877-301-8970 is the number. Quick break. Right back.
Today at WGBHnews.org, Mayor Curtatone has ordered police to ignore immigration violations. Is good politics for Somerville also good policy? If you missed it on the radio, catch it at WGBHnews.org right now.
Summer and sweltering heat are almost here. But before you eat all those popsicles, a warning. The sugar in them may be addictive. I'm Kara Miller. That's on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and HBX, the online learning initiative powered by Harvard Business School faculty for college sophomores, juniors, and seniors who want to learn the language of business. Accepting applications for June at hbx.hbs.edu. And Triumph Modular, offering Sprout Space, a pre-designed temporary building that can help you resolve space issues for schools, retail, healthcare, and more. Triumph, redefining modular. You can learn more at triumphmodular.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Jared Bowen is here filling in for vacationing. Jim Browning, and even more important, the mayor of the city of Boston is here. Now, before we get back to all this depressing stuff, because everything is wrong, this is a great story. Tell everybody what's going on with these Red Sox games for kids.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, tell about this is neat.
Well, the Red Sox and the Highland Foundation teamed up together with the Parks Department in the city of Boston to bring a Fenway experience to the neighborhoods. And this coming Sunday, what they're going to do, a few Sundays throughout the summer, we're going to set up a big screen to watch the away games for the Red Sox in the city of Boston and bring the experience of Yawkey Way to the park. We're going to have hot dog vendors and popcorn, and everything's going to be given away for the kids. But it's really an opportunity for kids to be able to get the experience of Fenway who might not have it. And the first one is Sunday at Ramsey Field, the Jim Rice Field. At 4 o'clock, 2 o'clock. So Roxbury Sunday, the 25th at 2 o'clock at Jim Rice Field. The Red Sox are playing Tampa Bay, and then we're going to have other ones in June at Franklin Park, in Dorchester at 4 o'clock, and then back in July in Boston Common. So we have it three different days. It's an experience. We're going to see what works, and then hopefully be able to keep this going as the seasons go on, keep it longer. We're also, one thing about our Parks Department, we've put about 46 new programs in the Parks Department this year, so we're programming our parks a lot more.
That's great. I think that's a great, fun idea. Great, fun idea.
I want to ask about the arts, and I actually followed you the other night at the Elliot Norton Awards, which is our
stalker.
The local version of the Tonys.
It was great.
I was presenting right after you, so I only heard how you addressed the theater crowd intermittently because I was waiting in the wings. But did I hear you say that you are in the process now and you actually interviewed somebody for the Arts Commissioner position this week?
Yeah, we're in the process right now of entering the Arts, actually Chief of Arts and Culture for the City of Boston. It's a cabinet-level position. I think we have about 200 applicants that applied. It's going to take a little time to go through all the applications, but it really is going to be the first time probably in 25 years in the city of Boston that we're really taking a real focus on the arts and culture in the city. We've separated that department from tourism and special events, and we've allocated some money in the budget for this. During the campaign, the arts community wanted a percent of the budget allocated to this fund. We weren't able to do a full percent. Our budget's $2.7 billion, but we're creating an office, a good infrastructure there. And arts and culture really transponds across the whole city and throughout every city department, whether it's public works or schools or development. So we're excited about it, and we're excited about getting a real top-notch quality person.
Well, in that vein, I looked at the job description, and it's quite expansive. It's yes. It's everything from putting arts in the schools to being a liaison with the arts community to a lot of fundraising to making sure there are public events. So there's a lot that you're looking for this one person. But what's really central to you that you want to come out of this new position?
Well, this person's going to have support, too. And this person is going to be a cabinet chief. So the diversity of what the person's responsible for, every week is going to be sitting at a table with the different departments. Really, we want to make Boston promote Boston's art scene. We have a lot of great local artists here in the city of Boston. We have a lot of great institutions, too, the larger institutions. And one thing that I think that our children are missing, and we spoke a couple callers ago, is arts and culture in the schools. I mean, you see a school that has arts in it, it does well. Boston Arts Academy, great example. It's a high school in Boston. People want to go to – kids want to go to that school.
Very talented kids.
Parents want them to go to that school. And you see some energy there. Every school that I've gone into in Boston that has some form or shape of an art program – you feel excitement in the school. So it really is important for Boston. And, you know, and we talked about this a lot. Every major country in the world has a cabinet level position for arts and culture. And here we are in Boston, a world class city. We're going to be promoting tourism and other things. We want to make sure we're on that level.
Let's go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
How about Jerome in Boston?
Mayor. My question is very, very quick. Market Basket. The prices are 30% lower. It's obvious when the Market Basket's closer to a Stop and Shop, they lower their prices. We were talking about disposable income for casinos and jobs for casinos. The Market Basket in Chelsea has 700 jobs. You open up two of those, that's more jobs than you're probably going to get out of a casino.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, do you have a question, Jerome?
Yeah, why don't we have Market Baskets in Boston?
Okay, thank you. To be honest with you, I'm not sure. I think I'll have to check with the BRA to see if we have any proposals for Market Baskets. One thing that we're trying to do, there are certain neighborhoods in our city that have a lack of good opportunity for good fresh grocery and produce. Certainly, I'm not opposed to Market Basket. Never said I feel that competition's good. I know that Market Basket has great products for communities, and I suggest that if Market Basket is listening to us, contact the city if there is an issue. I'm certainly not opposed to looking at it, and not opposed to advocating Market Basket as another option for groceries in neighborhoods.
Okay, let's take another call. Thank you for the call, Jerome.
How about Lucas?
Hi, Lucas.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Great.
I'm glad the arts came up in schools because I think that's kind of a solution to one of the things I want to talk about. But the problems about schools really get to me. I'm a teacher. I've been in teaching for a long time. I've seen schools do well. I've seen them do bad. And just like any organization, I think they just go through time. But I guess there could be a whole systemic issue within the whole city. But I just want to ask a specific question. It's kind of a rhetorical question. Do you think you could teach anybody math, science, English, when they're coming into your classroom with trauma, with problems at home, with problems on the street, fearing for their life at the worst, but also just dealing with a lot of the crazy messages they get in our culture? And I know part of this is philosophical because it's tough to regulate what a free culture is going to send, what kind of messages they're going to send to their children. But kids come into a school with a ton of baggage. And I'm telling you, you could have the best school in the world, and you're still struggling despite this wave that is going on outside. So I think the arts do bring a wonderful solution to this issue because they build community. But I'm really interested in hearing what sort of community building efforts are going on around the city.
Thanks, Lucas. And I couldn't agree with you more. You know, a lot of our challenges with our young people actually is not in the classroom. It's when they leave the classroom and after school and before the classroom. We're working. One of the issues that we have, and actually, I was asked this question by a reporter out in front of before I came on for this interview, was we have to really work on creating more opportunities in neighborhoods for parents, job opportunities. And a lot of these young people that go to our schools and older kids that go to our schools, their parents don't have opportunities. They don't have an education. They don't have a job. And people simply say, get a job. There's no jobs for them, number one. And there's no training for people. And, you know, we've put a big emphasis on high-tech and biotech, trying to recruit high-tech and biotech to the city of Boston. And part of the biotech is manufacturing of medical devices, where we can use that industry where you don't need a college degree, you don't need a PhD, you can work in with a high school or GED and with good job training. And we're working right now to try and attract that industry here. And we collaborated actually with five cities last week, calling it kind of the high-tech rail, high-tech council, myself, Cambridge, Braintree, Quincy, and Somerville, on how do we attract a bigger industry here to this area. And we're going to collaborate more like that so we can, they're going to the biotech conference, we're going down to see they're going to be represented there and try and attract some of this industry here to Boston. And you have to. And Lucas, you, as a teacher, you know this better than anyone else. We can put a social worker in the classroom. We can put a nurse in the classroom. We can put all the supports there. You're absolutely right. We have to help the communities outside the classroom as well.
Thank you for the call, Lucas. You want to take another call, Mr. Mayor?
Sure. Let's. How about Arthur from Somerville?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Mr. Mayor. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I drive for both, well, part-time. I drive for Uber and for Lyft. And my question is, a couple of people have mentioned in the Lyft drivers community and in the Uber driver community that they're getting pulled over by the Boston Hackney Division.
Okay.
That's who runs the regular taxis, the Hackney Division.
By the police you're talking about?
Yeah, they're getting pulled over by the police and issued citations as if they were picking up someone who flagged them down. And the ironic thing about Uber and Lyft is it takes the cash business out of the equation. So there's no way for, if you don't use the app to call me, there's no way I could pick you up if you flagged me down.
Well, let me just, before we talk about the cash issue, let's talk about the pulling over. First of all, the police can't pull you over. I don't believe they have the right to pull you over just because you're an Uber, and I don't know how they would know you're an Uber car or a Lyft car. I don't think there's anything.
Well, Lyft, unfortunately, we have the pink mustache that gives us away.
Yeah, they're okay. Pretty distinctive.
All right, so Lyft, you know, but I mean, Uber cars, you wouldn't know who you're pulling over, so I think a police officer would have a hard time with that. And I'm not sure if see, it seems like there's a lot of emotion running right now, and everyone's blaming everyone of something wrong. I'd be surprised to hear that. I think if a Boston police officer pulls you over for a violation, it's a violation of either running a red light, taking a right on red when not supposed to, going through a stop sign, or whatever the violation might be. But I will ask about that just to make sure that we're not doing it.
I know. Thank you for the call, Arthur. Our number is 877-301-8970, and our email address, bpr@wgbhnews.org. Did I goof that up? BPR at WGBH News. I think I looked it up.
Well, we have an email right here.
We have an email right here.
I think we're giving it out correctly.
Okay. I hope so. We're giving it out correctly. We have a call that came in from Twitter, too. I want to get to that, and then we can get to the email. Can East Boston get help from city government to help with the onslaught of development? The BRA is non-existent. We need a new master plan. I didn't know the East Boston was getting overwhelmed.
Yeah, they're starting to. I was at a coffee hour yesterday in the park over there, and many residents came to me. There's some big developments going on in Eastie that neighbors have concerns about. The BRA certainly has. We've made some changes in the BRA. We have a way to go, but we're certainly open and a lot more responsive to the community than I think in the past. And I know that I'm actually going to be looking at the development in East Boston and talking to the electeds. There was a master plan in East Boston back in the year 2000, so we have to look and upgrade.
Well, this
that.
Is huge. This is huge housing in Boston in general. Big. I mean, there's a lot of luxury housing, $3,000. I can't imagine who wants to pay $3,000 a month to rent an apartment, but they do.
That's a cheap one.
I guess so. But speaking of apartments, college kids are spending $5,000. I'm sure you read in that Globe series about this terrible situation. If people don't know about it, that these college kids come here, Northeastern, Boston College, BU, they all get pretty hammered for sending these kids off to live in these off-campus apartments for up to $5,000 a month with rats and not fire escapes. And a young woman was killed because she was on the third floor and she couldn't get out of the apartment. But they also hit on the city as well. And again, this is before you came, but nonetheless, it's a big deal that last year the city of Boston is supposed to inspect these rental units. There are approximately 154 rental units in the city, and officials only conducted 2,300 of these inspections. I know we asked you if you replaced the head of the inspections department because of that. You said no, he was going over to the BRA. I think he's going to the BRA.
He's going to be doing zoning in the city of Boston.
Yeah. But is that about money or is that about not enough inspectors? 2,000 out of 154,000 is not many.
It's I can't really comment on how things were done in the past. I know that next week there are 1,500 letters going out to 1,500 homeowners in the city of Boston that are the worst offenders with violations, and we're going to begin inspecting those apartments in those housing units starting next week. We have a team of people going out there. We have a process that's put in place now. If we need to hire more inspectors, I will hire more inspectors to make sure we do this, the program that's been instituted. And this is the home inspection program where people have to register their homes. We made a change last week in that program, just simply that anyone who owns a 1-6 family that's owner-occupied, you will not have to pay to register your apartment. However, you still have to register your apartment. But this gives us the tools we need to get into these apartments. And we're starting now, and throughout the summer, we're going to be continually doing that. We're asking homeowners and absentee homeowners to keep your property up. If not, we're coming to get you. We can get you on.
Well, I love that. We're coming to get you.
$300 a violation per violation, and $300 a day on top of that. So we're taking this very serious. That incident that happened in Brighton, right here,
horrible.
In Austin, actually, is horrible. Young woman, she was here learning. Her parents had to come over to bury her. These young people, they don't know. They rent an apartment. There's 7 or 8 people living in an apartment. It's dangerous circumstances. The place is unfit to live in. But they're not going to complain because they have no place to go. So we are going after that very aggressively.
How much? And we've had a number of email questions about that as well. And a lot of people are blaming the colleges, saying that they think that they're over enrolling and they're responsible for large influx of students into the city, especially in certain areas where we have the larger universities. So how much of the onus do you want to put on the universities to help address this problem?
Well, two things. One is we're going to be meeting with the universities to talk about this issue. We're going to bring on all the colleges over the course of the next couple of weeks because we have to try and identify where these young people are living. And we think that they know off campus where they live. So we want these addresses of these landlords so we can go out and inspect the property, number one. Number two, I really want to encourage colleges as best they can to have 100% of their students living on campus. Now, some of the colleges have the ability because they have the land to do that. Some don't. The ones that don't have the ability, I'm not against having them enter into a partnership, public-private partnership, when I say public, with the university, to build dorms and to monitor and police those dorms themselves. I know Boston College has a master plan to put 100% of their students on campus. They got approved through the city before I became mayor of the city of Boston, and I'm hoping that they'll start to build these dorms and get these young people on campus. That's going to be the answer. Over-enrollment, I think some colleges are over-enrolling. I think there are some colleges that aren't over-enrolling either because they have issues with class space. So, but I think this is a serious issue. And it's not just a serious issue in the sense of somebody losing their life, but it's a quality of life issue for communities. I mean, if you go to Mission Hill or you go to parts of this neighborhood that we're in or you go to other parts, I mean, people are just, from the month of September through May, they want to leave because their neighborhood's just overrun with college parties or even graduate college parties. So we do have some work to do here, and I know it's been an issue for a long time in the community. But again, we have a new chief of environmental inspections, ISD. And we're really good. We're putting in some policy that's there. We have all the tools we need there. We just need to enforce it now.
How do you sleep at night? Seriously, I'm thinking you all the things we've just talked about, and you know that you have to keep on top of them because you know people are just going to keep coming back and coming back. I mean, how do you manage it
all day long? Yeah, and it's funny because when you talk about something, we have a lot of great things going on in the city, and we're doing a lot of good things, and then somebody will come up with an important issue for them, kind of obscured to me. What are you doing about this thing? And I'm like, oh God, and you got to go back and do something about it because people want an answer. I mean, not everyone's concerned about Uber. There are people listening to us. What is Uber? or the arts and culture. They're concerned about the parks, or they're concerned about making sure that their trash is picked up on the street or whatever it might be. So there are a lot of issues. But as I get more into it, you get more into the swing of this thing. And, I love serving the people of Boston, and I want to deliver the best services to them. One thing that happened last week, I know I'm digressing, but
go ahead.
We had Boston Shines, and we were cleaning the streets up, and I saw a person in the street, and she said to me, I have a complaint. And I said, what's your complaint? She said, there wasn't enough trash to pick up. She was, you're doing a great job of cleaning the streets. And, I tell people all the time that, picking trash off the street is not the city's responsibility. The landowners, the landlords, the tenants, people, you should chip in here. Make us have the cleanest city. We're gonna do it, but it shouldn't be our responsibility when there's trash in the street. If you see a piece of paper, pick it up and throw it in the barrel.
You know, we just got I don't know if it came from Twitter or Facebook or someplace, asking about John Rosenthal's gun billboard.
Yeah.
You know, John Rosenthal has been a longtime anti-gun activist. He has that big billboard on the Mass Pike listing, you know, number of children that have died.
It's practically a landmark at this point.
It's practically a landmark, and it's being moved.
Yeah.
What's the deal
there? John owned the property. He sold the property, and the new owners want to use the property probably. I don't know what they're going to do with it, but he's looking for a place. I've spoken to John. You know, I actually thought the other day, should we put on the top of City Hall? if it needs a temporary home, it'll go up there. But
give it a little color or something, liven it up somewhat.
John Rosenthal is someone who has done so much, raised so much money with the organization Stop Handgun Violence. That he was talking about handgun violence long before other people were. And, you know, he does some great things in our city. He also has a committee to end homelessness, and he does that as well. But to stop handgun violence is an important billboard. It tells a story just by changing the numbers on there, how many young people died.
Yeah.
And we will find a home for John's billboard.
Okay. By the way, I didn't mean color in the upbeat sense because this is about handgun violence, but just at City Hall, as you've discussed before, Mr. Mayor, it's not exactly the most beautiful city.
No, we could cover a good part of the building by saying.
Yeah, and speaking of temporary homes, temporary home for the billboard, but you also addressed that issue in the campaign about exploring other options, about selling off that very, I assume it's a very lucrative piece of property in downtown Boston.
So.
Where does that stand now?
One thing in this budget, we put money in the budget to look at a renovation of City Hall to see what it would look like as far as bringing it up to code and trying to change the environment inside the building. It's not my top priority right now. As you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of other things that I'm worried about and focused on. But it's something that we're not opposed to and we're going to look at when the time is appropriate. We are going to do a study to see. There's one office in City Hall. It's the environmental office. And they were able to do a renovation there. And when you walk into that area that they are, it's like you don't realize you're in City Hall. It's completely different what they've done with it, with LED lights and changing the structure inside. So we're looking at that. We did improve City Hall we added greeters.
I love that idea.
So we have
little red jackets.
When you walk in, somebody says hello to you and they help you with the building. And I'll tell you, the first day it happened, Sheila Dillon, who's the chief of housing, walked in and she didn't know the greeters were there, and there was somebody in front of her. And the person stopped, how are you doing? Good. And they were talking to a story and I'm looking for a marriage license. And the greeter said to the person, congratulations. And Sheila came up to the office and she said, I didn't think I was in City Hall. it was pretty funny. And we're getting great response on that. And it's co-op students from Northeastern and they get a chance to meet public people and people. So it's been successful.
Yeah, they look very snappy too.
Yes. Yeah.
Want to take some more phone calls, Mr. Mayor?
Sure. How about George in Hyde Park?
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Good, George.
Mr. Mayor, I had the luxury to meet you when you were first running for election. Congratulations on your election.
Thank you, sir.
I was the native gentleman that had met you at the Mass Association Minority Law Enforcement Officers. One of the questions I have for you, Mr. Mayor, I noticed that a lot of cultures and nationalities are recognized. And on behalf of the Native American community, I'd like to know if you're... administration is planning on having a Native American representative to represent our community, and would your administration be adverse to having a Native American powwow perhaps on the Boston Public Gardens open to the public?
No, the second part, absolutely not. I would welcome it. I'd suggest you give us a call in City Hall. The first part, you know, we're very sensitive in City Hall, city government, to different nationalities and every nationality. I think that's very important. We do have, which is in effect the Native Americans, but we have the Office of New Bostonians that we're making sure that we reach out to all the different communities in the city of Boston. We have in not every language, but we have some communities represented in our Office of Neighborhood Services with different liaisons that we have. And it's something that when I go back, I will look into it and absolutely see where we are with that.
Thank you for the call, George. You know, speaking of that, one of our colleagues here, David Bernstein, wrote a piece in Boston Magazine talking about, you know, you had really talked a lot about diversity when you were running for a candidate for mayor, and 2/3 of the city employees you've hired since you took office have been people of color. But according to Bernstein's piece, of the 43 current non-cabinet department heads, only 11 are of color, and the and in your close cabinet, the people that are of color are the Daniel Koh, who's, what is he, 29 years old? He's a young man, Asian American chief of staff, and then two other guys, Felix Arroyo, John Barros, who ran for mayor. So what's the plan? What's the deal with only 11 of 43 people of color?
Well, the 11 of 43 is simply that we have department heads that were there before I took over, and some people, a lot of people doing a great job, and you don't want to move them just because of who they are.
Yeah.
So we have some work to do there. Clearly in my cabinet, too, we have several open spots in the cabinet that we're looking at. I mean, we have arts and culture. We have transportation and sanitation is another department that we have that's available, that's open as far as cabinet level. So we do have some work. We have some work to do there. But we're trying every day. It's something that you know, I make sure that as we talk at cabinet meeting or we talk about staff meetings, it's something that we're constantly working on, the diversity of City Hall. We're also making sure that we have the gay community represented in City Hall, and we're working hard there as well. So there's a lot of different constituencies. And Boston is, you know, the benefit of Boston is that it's a very diverse in so many different ways. Not the downside, but the downside is that we don't have enough spots for everyone, and trying to get everybody, every community felt like they're represented is difficult. And, you know, I think we've done a fair job in the first 5.5 months of this, and we still have a way to go, but we're going to get there.
You know what I wonder? What's the biggest change for you, Marty, like personally in 5.5 months? I mean, you must be recognized everywhere you go now.
That's a change. I mean, I was talking to I pulled over the other day. We pulled over to get something at J.P. Licks in Alston and in Brighton and actually Huntington Ave. And I got out of the car for a minute to talk to Laurie on the phone, and I kept getting stopped. And she goes, "Will you go back in the car?" you know, it's
this
like,
is your significant other. Yeah. I'm not going to ask you any marriage questions.
So you don't have to. But you know, I think the change is the amount of issues that come up on the course of a day, and it's important for me to know those issues. You know, as a legislator, it's usually what's the hot couple of legislative issues that day, or what advocacy during that particular time. Now it's wherever you go, and I'm learning this as I go on. This answer would have been different a month ago, but wherever, like yesterday, for example, in East Boston, I was asked about development.
Yep.
I was asked about expanding schools and improving schools. I was asked about park and recreation. Can we turn the lights on? I was asked about the airport and the traffic patterns of the planes. I was asked about building a senior center in East Boston. I was asked about the library that's in East Boston, Orient Heights, that's empty now. What do we do with that? So every day, and you got to have an answer, and you got to have to kind of know what's going on with it. I mean, I have great people around me to answer some of the questions. I don't have all the answers. But I think it's you have to have a good grasp of what's going on in the city. And then you also have to know when you go into a community that the issues are very different. You know, and I'll give you an example, Alston, Brighton. You have to know, first of all, you have to know if you're in Alston or you're in Brighton.
I know. I don't know myself.
and then you also need to make sure that when you're talking about the development issues, that they're different in those communities. And they're different in every community. So every neighborhood's different. They're very similar, but they're very different.
So what do? Do you make a list?
No,
I mean, you have to figure out your priorities, and it's going to be really difficult.
I think as mayor of the city of Boston, you don't have a priority. I think as mayor of the city of Boston, you have everyone's issue is your priority. You have to make sure that, you know, we have to make sure that when we have an event in the city that the police commissioner is doing a good job in keeping people safe. We have to make sure that when restaurants and bars open, that the fire goes in and make sure that the sprinkler system is correct in those. You know, you have to make sure we have to continue to make sure that our schools improve, the schools that are strong, that they stay strong. So I think that you, as mayor, you have to kind of watch it all. And it's really important to build strong supports around you. Some of the people that have gone from one administration to the next, their institutional knowledge is invaluable.
Yeah.
So you don't want to just say, I'm getting rid of them because that person, whatever, wasn't with us or whatever.
Yep.
If they have that institutional knowledge that you just can't replace.
Well, apparently the East Boston contingent is very strong because we have a number of emails from them, including about prostitution, which I have to tell you, I do see some of in downtown Boston. I spent a lot of, you know, late nights leaving theaters and screenings and whatnot. But this question comes from Linda in East Boston, who says, what can be done about the Johns and the men soliciting such activities in store parking lots and inner city streets?
Well, we're working on that now with the police commissioner. We're upping upping in the amount of officers handling that, and we're also looking at the Johns more. We've done a lot during the campaign and since that time talking about prostitution in the city of Boston, viewing the women who are being prostituted as victims, and we're doing a lot of work around that, and we have some great people working on that issue. And we're also not just in downtown or not just in East Boston, throughout the community. And so we have a long way to go as well on that, but part of a lot of the women that are out there, and I'm assuming there's some men out there as well, a lot of it is people that are drug addicted, and they're doing it for their habit. So we have to do a better job of trying to deal with drug addiction as well in the city.
Do you want to try to squeeze in a couple more calls before you go, Mr. Mayor?
Sure. Let's bring in, how about Brian from South Boston?
Hello.
How are you?
Hi, Brian.
I'm well, thanks. It's an honor to speak to you, Mayor Walsh. I just moved to Boston about a year ago. I got to meet Elizabeth Warren last week, so I'm on a hot streak. Thank you.
Oh, that's good.
I just have a quick question. I wanted to know, to have the opportunity to speak with someone that might actually have an opinion on this. Why do you feel it would not be a good idea to put kids that are in public schools in uniform?
No, I think we actually have some public schools in Boston that have uniforms. There's no rule against it, and there's no rule for it. And I think, you know, uniforms work. I went to a parochial school. We had to wear a uniform every day, a shirt and tie. And I know that in Boston public schools, we have many schools that have uniforms, and many of the lower schools have instituted a uniform, whether it's a golf shirt or a T-shirt,
yeah,
with their school name on there. And you know, they really seem to be promoting it more. I think years ago it was a bigger issue. Everyone wanted everyone in uniforms, and then there was a big pushback. But today that pushback's not there. It's actually easier for a family to have uniforms. It's less on their economy because they don't have to be buying different clothes for every day. But we do. I don't know what the policy is as far as it's not consistent across the board. It's something I will look into.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of them, too. I've seen a lot of them in charter schools where they have.
Charter schools have them, too. But
yeah,
our public schools have uniforms.
They wear a lot uniform. of the charter used to. I don't know if they still do. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks
for
having
me. To talk to us today. And you don't have any gray hairs yet, so you must have
No, there's a few hidden by this.
Okay. There's the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh. He joins us once a month. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to see you. And coming up, actor Leonard Nimoy. You may know him as Spock from Star Trek, but he is very much earthbound and a product of Boston. He joins us to talk about his appearances tonight and tomorrow night with the Boston Pops. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This is what listener-supported radio sounds like.
But when the Red Sox clinched the series with Koji Uehara finishing off the game with a strikeout, we thought of our parents and our grandparents, fans who waited nearly a lifetime to see the Red Sox win just one championship. We've now seen three in the past 10 years.
Your support gives the WGBH news team the tools and the time to tell the stories that matter. 89.7 WGBH, your home for public radio.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2014 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More information at Lincoln.com. And North Shore Music Theater's production of Anything Goes, the High Seas musical featuring Cole Porter's classic songs You're the Top, De Lovely, Friendship, and many more. Anything Goes, playing June 3rd through the 15th. NSMT.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Those of you who are no strangers to the Museum of Science know him as the man who voices the New England time capsule film. Those of you who are into fine art know him as a photographer. And Trekkies, you know him as Spock. That is right. Actor Leonard Nimoy joins us in Studio 3. He's in town by way of the Boston Pops, hosting Out of This World, a space-themed production, which is on stage tonight and tomorrow at Symphony Hall. He also made a documentary with his son, filmmaker Adam Nimoy. It's titled Leonard Nimoy's Boston. It premiered last night on Channel 2 for future screenings, and there are going to be plenty. If you missed it last night, go to WGBH.org. Leonard Nimoy, so great to see you. Thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. I just watched this documentary, which is so fantastic. You and your son walk all around Boston, the Boston you grew up in, until the age of 18 when you left for Hollywood.
Out of South Station.
So we have a clip of the documentary right here, and it's when you're in your, 16 or 17, when you're working for a rather disreputable vacuum company right on Boylston Street in 1948. Here's a listen.
They ran what they call a bait-and-switch operation. They would advertise a used Electrolux vacuum cleaner, which was a famous name, for $9 or $10. And the job was to sell upward. You got one for a sample to show. Don't sell it. The machine you want to sell cost about $100. So it took a certain amount of confidence and salesmanship. It was useful later in going on some of the acting auditions that I went on.
This was such a sweet documentary, you walking around with your son, until we realized that you were, you know, you're a shifty salesman.
Very shifty.
I was dangerous.
Very shifty.
But prior to that, I have to tell you, I was so moved because you grew up in the West End. And for people who don't know what the West End is, it's like the Lower East Side of New York. It's where
That's right.
immigrants went, and, and you were all crowded, as I know you were, in apartment buildings. And that, and it was right adjacent to Mass General Hospital in the Charles River, prime location. And because of that reason, it was leveled, taken by eminent domain. So I'm wondering, what is it like that the fact that you essentially can't go home now, that you have all these wonderful memories of where you grew up, but it doesn't exist anymore?
It's very sad. Many years ago, maybe 25 years ago, I took my came to Boston with my wife, and I wanted to show her where I had grown up, and we could not find the street. We walked into the area that was the West End, but the streets are so totally reconfigured that there's no connection to what it used to be. The only connection we found that my son Adam and I found when we were making the documentary was the St. Joseph's Church. And we actually sat on the steps, he and I, of the St. Joseph's Church, and I pointed to the left where I could show him, where I could actually, where we could see St. Joseph's from the window of our apartment building. It was only half a block away. But now it was so totally different that it was unrecognizable. So in a sense, I feel uprooted, but at the same time, I still have a great connection with the city. I love being in Boston. I always look forward to coming back.
You know, Leonard Nimoy, I wonder how your parents reacted to taking of their neighborhood. Your father was a barber in Mattapan. Your mother was a homemaker. How did they react?
Well, they were very stubborn about leaving. They were they were among the last people to leave. They stayed and stayed and stayed. I left in 1949. And they were there until the very end. I think that building was one of the last to come down. They left, I think, in 1959. And by that time, the West End was just gone. And they would have stayed forever until they passed away. But they were just forced to move. They had to get out. Well, the building would have been torn down around them, so they moved out to Dorchester.
And did they keep in touch at all with the old neighbors from the West
End? Oh, yeah. The West End was a very close-knit neighborhood. It was really a village, in a way. There was a Harvard sociologist named Gans who wrote a book called The Urban Villagers about the West End. It was a unique neighborhood, absolutely unique.
So where did the young teen Leonard Nimoy hang out when he was a young ruffian around Boston?
I split my time between the Elizabeth Peabody House, which was on Charles Street, and the West End House, which was on Blossom Street. The Peabody House was a wonderful place that had a sports program, a science program. They had a science lab where my brother began his interest in science, and he became a chemical engineer with a graduate degree from MIT. And they also had a wonderful theater, a 375-seat theater, beautiful theater. And that's where I first started acting when I was 8 years old. I walked out on stage as Hansel in a production of Hansel and Gretel. And somehow I just kept on doing it. And by the time I was about 17... there was a play being done there called Awake and Sing, and I was cast in that as the juvenile. It was my first time in an adult drama, which is about a family very much like my own family, three generations living in one apartment just like we did, my grandparents and my parents and my brother and I. And I was so taken with it. I was so moved by being involved in a play that really spoke to our generation about our people that I decided this was the way I wanted to make my life, my living, and this is the way I wanted to live my life. And that's when I decided to move to California and study acting seriously.
Well, it's so hard to believe that with this voice that you have, and of course we know it so well, as we mentioned at the Museum of Science, that you had a very thick Boston accent.
I did. I went to school at the Pasadena Playhouse School of the Theater. I was only there for about 6 months. I was disappointed in the school in general, but I had a great speech teacher. And when I left Boston, if you had asked me what part I played in the TV show, I would say I was Spock from Star Trek.
So it still comes right back to you. You can never escape it.
After about 6 months of hard work, it was really hard work. The change of speech is not easy. And because there's more to it than just the sound. There's a whole psychological thing about the way you sound. And I really didn't want to let it go. I thought, this is who I am, you know. But then I thought I'd better change my speech because it'll make it possible for me to get more different kinds of work.
We're talking with Leonard Nimoy, who is in town by way of the Boston Pops, and also because this documentary that he made with his son premiered last night on WGBH Channel 2. You know, everyone knows you as Spock from Star Trek, but when I look at your resume, you were in almost every single solitary great television show from the late 50s and early 60s, Sea Hunt, The Twilight Zone, Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford.
Right.
Yeah, Perry Mason, Rawhide. That was with Clint Eastwood, wasn't it?
Clint Eastwood, that's
right. Yeah, The Untouchables. That was another great series. You got any good stories from any of those? got any tales from the young Clint Eastwood Perry Mason or anything?
Those were struggling days. I was happy to get each and every one of those jobs. I lived in a neighborhood a few blocks away from Lloyd Bridges, who was the star of this Sea Hunt television series.
I remember it.
And when things got really desperate, I would get in my car and drive by his house very slowly to see if maybe he was outside watering the lawn. And one time it actually worked. I was driving by. I had worked the show a couple of times. I needed a job, and I was driving by, and there he was outside. And I yelled, "Hey, Lloyd, how are you? Leonard Nimoy, remember?" "Oh, yeah, yeah, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm looking for a job." He said, "Just a minute." He went inside the house, made a phone call, came back out, and he said, "You start in 2 days." I had a three-day job, which paid a couple $100 and paid the rent that month.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
You were also on Bonanza.
Yes, a couple times.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, that's right. And Gunsmoke a couple times. And, I was on all those shows. I did them all. I did Rawhide. I did Wagon Train. I did... I played
the man
cops
from Uncle,
and robbers,
the man from
and I played good guys, bad guys. I played Indians, and every once in a while, I even did some science fiction. You know?
So, of course, you landed in this show that a lot of people have heard about. So, I have a confession to make to you. A few years ago, I was in Greece. I was standing at the Plaka at the base of the Acropolis, and I heard this very distinctive voice behind
me. Were you there?
I was there, and I turned around because I think that sounds like Leonard Nimoy. I spun around, and I saw this tall, distinguished gentleman. And what did I do to figure out if it was really you? I looked at your ears. I was such a moron, but I feel somewhat validated because I've come to understand that you brought a lot of yourself to Spock.
I did. I was very fortunate to find a role that welcomed me, and I welcomed it. I took it to heart. I was very serious about that character because I identified with him a lot. Spock was a character who was sort of outside the mainstream. He was the other, the alien, and I grew up feeling that way. I felt that I was one of the minority. And Spock was not at home on Vulcan because he was half human. He was not at home on Earth because he was half Vulcan. The kids on Vulcan teased him because he was a half breed, and that's why he went into the space work. I was struck by what the character had in the way of intelligence, and usefulness, and professionalism, and dignity. Above all, dignity. It meant a lot to me.
Why did the Leonard Nimoy, the real Leonard Nimoy, feel like you were an outsider? Why?
Well, I grew up in this very mixed neighborhood. The people on the floor below us were Italian. The people on the floor below that were Irish. We had very good friends in all of the denominations. But being Jewish, I was definitely in a minority.
You were in a minority.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
So I felt like I was not mainstream, you know.
But that must be there must have been some comfort out in Los Angeles and Hollywood because that's where a lot of people went when they're considered other because they have these other artistic sensibilities that they have
that's
these other selves. So did
well,
you find?
Well, it's true. I found a different kind of world in California where it was there was not that kind of strong cultural identity. It was an easier mix of people. Not that I enjoyed it more, but I felt I had a different feeling. I felt like, oh, okay, this is what California's all about. This is what Hollywood's all about. But the most important thing for me was to be involved in the arts. I wanted to make a living in the arts. And that's why I went to California, because I thought out there I had a chance to do it. And it worked out. It worked out for me, fortunately. It took a while. It took a while to build a career, but it worked out.
Leonard Nimoy, I read somewhere where you saved your last pair of ears.
I have them,
Where you got them? The bathroom?
They're in a small box with a glass front sitting on my desk to remind me of where I came from.
Okay. And I also read, and I thought this was fascinating, and maybe it relates to what you just said about feeling a little bit like an outsider, that when you worked as on Star Trek, you'd be very long days during the week, get through on Friday, and then you somehow maintained your role as Spock on Saturday and well into Sunday afternoon. What was that about?
Yeah, well, I guess you'd call it method acting. I was deep inside this character for many hours each week. 12 hours a day for 5 days a week, 60 hours a week. I was in the spot character. I'd come home, take off the makeup, grab something fast to eat, study my lines for tomorrow, and still in spot character, and go to sleep. Wake up in the morning and bang, right into the makeup chair and back into Spock. So the weekend was the only time that I had to slip out of the character, and it took a while. I could still feel Spock around all day Saturday, and he'd start to leave about midday on Sunday. And then I'd start to slip back into Leonard Nimoy. By Sunday night, I was free of Spock, but Monday morning, right back into character. For 3 years, that's the way it was.
So at the same time that you started your acting career in Hansel and Gretel, you also started a photography career. You were you're literally developing in your one bathroom that you're sharing with all of your family members.
Yes.
So you've had a lifelong passion for photography.
Yes, exactly.
What's your entry point there? What really draws you about the still?
A neighborhood friend in the West End showed me how to develop a roll of film and make a print in your own darkroom. You could go to the Kodak store, which was on Bromfield Street, and for 15 cents you could buy a package of chemicals, and that was all you needed, and maybe a packet of paper for another 15 to 25 cents. So with that kind of an investment, I could take the family camera and go out and shoot some pictures and come home and start developing and making prints immediately in the bathroom, which was exciting to me, very exciting. I stayed with my interest in photography forever, but got serious about it. When I finished Star Trek and did two seasons on Mission Impossible and left that show because I really had had enough of it, I went back to school to UCLA to study photography seriously because I really considered changing careers. What I realized was that I did not want to do commercial photography, shooting cars and clothes and fashion and that kind of thing. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do what's known as fine art photography. Very difficult to make a living at it, so I decided to stick with my acting career. But I've always loved photography, and I have continued to do it ever since.
We're speaking with Leonard Nimoy, who's done some very fascinating things with your career as a fine arts photographer. One of them was from a few years back, but I found this totally fascinating. Was the Big Body Project, where you photographed a lot of women that are not just a little bit heavy; they are really, really heavy,
large-bodied women. Yeah.
Yes, and they look a lot of them. Really beautiful, and you never see pictures like that. Why did you do that?
Well, it started with a woman who came to me after I was showing some of my earlier work from a project called Shekhinah in Northern California, where I had a home. And a woman came to me afterward, and she said, "I'm a model. I'm a different body type than you've been working with. Would you be interested in shooting me?" And she was a very large lady. And I was concerned. I thought, I'm not quite sure I know what to do with this, because I had been shooting classic type figures. She came to our studio, and my wife and I photographed her. And when I showed her pictures, she was quite large. When I showed her pictures along with other work, she was the one who got all the attention. People were fascinated, because you never see that.
Exactly.
That kind of nude figure, almost like sculpture. And I thought, there's something going on here in our culture that I think people are interested in and might want to learn about. So I found this group of women, large-body women in San Francisco, and I photographed them, and that became the full-body project.
What kind of reaction did you get? Because we never see or rarely see
I got a lot of interest, a lot of people asking the same question. Who are these people, and why are you shooting them? And I was shooting them because there is this cultural question in our society about what people should look like. And women in our culture are told what they should look like by the cosmetic companies, the clothing companies, the diet companies. People want to sell you something.
That's right.
Take these pills, buy these clothes, take this exercise program, buy it from us, and you will look like you're supposed to look, you know. Well, what are you supposed to? You're supposed to look like who you are. And people have been taught to chase this dream by paying something to somebody to try to achieve that kind of a look. So that's what it was all about. I thought it was very interesting to raise the conversation about this subject.
Did it change the way you made photography after? Because you just mentioned how you were sort of anxious about doing it and you didn't quite know how to do it. So it must have tested you. So did it?
You know, many years ago, I had a good friend named Marcia Tucker, who was the founder of the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. For a while, she was the chief curator at the Whitney Museum. She was a good friend and a great supporter of the arts, and she said to me, do what scares you as an artist. Do what scares you. Do the thing that you would normally shy away from and explore it. Let's find out what's there that scares you and bothers you. Maybe you'll find something interesting. And that's what I was thinking when I took on the full body project. I thought, this scares me. I'm going to do it.
Oh, go ahead, Jerry.
I was going to ask if you shoot on film or digital.
I shot almost exclusively on film, which I processed myself until my last project, which was called Secret Selves, which I shot in Northampton. Tell people about that.
That's a fascinating one, too.
Yeah. Well, I came across this this story from the ancient Greeks. Supposedly, there was a symposium discussing human angst. What is this thing that we all feel uneasy about? And Aristophanes, a poet, philosopher of the period, said that he had an explanation for human angst. He said, humans at one time were double people, attached back to back. We had four arms, four legs, and two heads.
Really?
And, yeah, and he said that the humans became very powerful and arrogant. And I don't know how you'd be powerful. I think you'd be encumbered, you know. But he said, anyway, that's what he said. And he said the gods became angry, and they sent Zeus to solve the problem. So Zeus took a big sword, split everybody in two, and sent them on their separate paths, and we became two hands, two feet, and one head. However, he said, ever since then, humans have felt some part of themselves is missing. Something is missing in their lives, and that's the explanation of human angst, people trying to get in touch with their other part of themselves to reintegrate, to become whole again. I thought, what a fascinating story. So we set up a series of interviews and portrait sessions in Northampton where I photographed 100 people. They were invited to come and have me photograph them as their secret or hidden or fantasy self. And boy, some wonderful people came in with that.
And you had a big exhibit at BU as well, that which was widely well received. Leonard Nimoy, it has been fascinating and wonderful and a great treat to speak with you. And thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate
tonight,
it.
Tonight, Symphony Hall.
Tonight, Symphony Hall. We're going to give all the info in just a second.
Yeah, you can catch Leonard Nimoy, tonight and Saturday at the Boston Pops, where he's hosting Out of This World, a space-themed production led by guest conductor Sarah Hicks. To learn more about tickets and showtimes, go to bso.org/Boston Pops. And if you want to see Leonard Nimoy's Boston, which he made with his son, filmmaker Adam Nimoy, go to WGBH.org for showtimes. Leonard Nimoy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Great pleasure.
It's Open Mic with Emily Rudy and her famous list of obsessions and observations. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Wisdom from down on Highway 61.
Bob Dylan was giving me a clue to learn how to separate Don Johnson, the public persona, from who I truly am.
Actor Don Johnson on Bob Dylan, the Buddha, and Johnson's new movie, Cold in July. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for WGBH comes from you and Seasons 4. For 44 years, the Outdoor Living Store on Mass Ave in Lexington, featuring a wide selection of contemporary and traditional outdoor furniture, plus a large selection of plants, statuary, and garden accessories. Seasons4.com. And National Nurses United, a voice of America's registered nurses, advancing the interests of nurses and patients for better patient care and patient safety. It's registered nurses who put the care in healthcare. NationalNursesUnited.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Joining us, as she does every Friday for Open Mic and her famous list of obsessions and observations, is Emily Rooney. Hi, Emily.
I noticed you didn't say gripes.
I didn't.
It may be one today.
I didn't say gripes.
Hey, Jared.
Hey, Emily. We get to play again, as always.
Yeah. So I understand that one of your gripes and obsessions for this week, and I think I'm with you on this one. People may recall that Aaron McFarlane was the FBI agent who was identified by the Boston Globe last week as shooting Ibrahim Todashev, who was killed a year ago this week, actually. And it was a controversial naming because the FBI didn't want him to be named. But in the course of the naming, we found out that he retired with a disability from the cash-strapped city of Oakland with a $52,000 a year pension
at age 31.
Correct.
And then he gets a full-time job with the FBI.
Yes, he does. So what do you think about this,
Emily? I think this is very common, is what I think. I think this happens all the time in fire departments, in police departments around the country, because this is the way it works. You know, you get to retire early with full pensions, even if you're not on disability. This guy's on disability, but disability cuts the gamut. you know, it can be emotional distress. It can be, what was his? It was something.
It wasn't clear.
Hurt a foot or something.
Wasn't clear what was wrong with him, since he was able to pass this rigorous physical test to get on the FBI. And the FBI says on its website, and by the way, the FBI has been stonewalling. This was Maria Sacchetti, who wrote the story again for The Globe in Thursday's paper, and stonewalling them. But she had to go to the website where it said that you have to be in excellent condition with no disabilities which would interfere in firearm use, raids, or defensive tactics, quote unquote. That's right on their website.
Makes you a little nervous, doesn't it, about how well they vet these people? I mean, you think of the CIA and you know, the FBI is the most well-vetted personnel in the world. How could this get through?
Well, to play devil's advocate for a moment, too, a lot of people say that if you're a police officer, inherently there are going to be a lot of lawsuits filed against you, and he has apparently had a couple.
That's
there have
true.
Been a number of internal affairs investigations. So is this – are we blowing things out of proportion for something that might be routine to just be part of a major city police department as he was in Oakland?
Yeah, but those are two different issues. I mean, it's one thing that he very well may have been just targeted randomly for police brutality. But he still put in for a pension that had nothing to do with that, and he's getting a full at age 31.
And what's most striking is that the city of Oakland, as also pointed out in this article, is just flat broke at this point.
Yeah.
Or not flat broke, but I mean, they're having serious financial issues and closing firehouses, and they have high crime that they're not able to meet, and yet they're paying out, as they will for the rest of his life, this, what, $51,000 a year, tax-free because it's
tax-free
disability?
Well, you know, here's the issue, and you always get into I get into a big fight about this with Jim all the time, so I always call him Mr. Union Defender,
yeah.
And he's a big union guy, and everybody understands the needs for unions in many professions. They do a lot of great good. Nobody's arguing there shouldn't be any unions. But what's happened in public employee unions, their power has become such, and this is all over the country, that the pensions and the benefits they awarded to people years ago to make up for not very good salaries, people died at young ages, and people's salaries weren't so great years ago. Now, if you're a teacher or you're a cop or you're a firefighter, particularly in Boston, your salary's pretty good. And now, happily, people live till they're 80, 85, 90 years old. So I think what you have to do with pensions is say, great, you know, we'll give you this great pension, but you cannot collect it until you're 60 or 65.
Yes, that's right.
You can't retire at 40.
Well, but a disability pension is something completely different.
Well, a disability, you're absolutely right. Yeah. And that's the question is, how can you be collecting
it's
a
bogus.
Disability?
I'm going to say this flat out. That's bogus.
Okay.
You couldn't be going into, you know, a tense situation, interrogating somebody. You're armed. The other officers around you are armed, and you've got a physical disability. It's total.
Yeah.
Bull.
You see this sometimes with police officers and firefighters. And
I remember that
famous
guy. Yeah, the Harold. What was his name? Arroyo?
He was the guy that – this is the firefighter. It was the bodybuilder. He was disabled, and yet he looked like Mr. Universe. And the other great one is the toll takers. The toll takers are not going to be with us that much longer on the Mass Turnpike. But remember the great stories about – and this is Howie Carr at the Boston Herald did hysterical stories about the toll takers being – attacked by their cash drawers on the Mass Turnpike. They would open the drawer, and the drawer would fall on top of them, and they'd be disabled for
I thought you were
going
to say it was carpal tunnel or something from handing the money.
That was part of the problem, too. Carpal tunnel from handing out the money, a disability from handing the money out, you know, in the cold weather and that sort of thing. But there were a lot of injuries among those toll takers. Very
hilarious.
And is there no sense of checks after this? So you file, you get permanent lifetime disability, and then there are no checks, no physicals that you have to undergo? So apparently he disappeared for a couple of years, got a real estate license, and who knows what happened in that time, and then
apparently
suddenly
not.
4 years later he's with the FBI?
Apparently not.
Now, what was the second thing you want to talk about, Emily?
Oh!
We're so excited.
This is earth-shattering to me, Marjorie.
Tell us the news, Jared.
That Emily Rooney has bought a bike.
I did.
Emily Rooney, who has complained about cyclists in this city and in this environment for forever, since as long as I've known her, bought a bike. Why did you buy a bike?
Well, because I've been on the talk about disabled list. I'm genuinely disabled.
I don't even see a crutch anymore.
I know, but I can't play tennis. I still can't. I've still got the knee is still very, very sore. Can't play tennis. Can't do any of my racket sports, but I can cycle because I can move the leg. I can do the knee up and down, just not sideways. So I bought a bike.
And where are you going to go?
I'm going to mostly on the Esplanade.
Okay, now we have to get further details on this bike situation.
It's gorgeous.
On this bike situation. First of all,
it's blue.
Let's have the details on the bike.
It's like something called a Trek. It's a, what they call it, a hybrid, because it's It's not a racing bike, and it's not a mountain bike, but it's got the thicker tires, which you want for downtown because there's a lot of ruts and nails and all that stuff. So it's also, I guess it's kind of a man's bike, but I didn't want the bar straight across, but now they make them kind of on a slant, so it's much easier to...
Is it one of those sort of European bikes or Wicked Witch of the West bikes?
Wicked Witch.
That's suddenly the image I have of Emily pedaling along.
With Toto.
Just to get swept up. She'll land over in Oklahoma somewhere.
Well, here's what I want to know. One of my theories about the kind of friction that goes on nonstop between bicyclists and drivers is the outfits that the bicyclists wear. I mean, you know, we're talking the spandex and the orange.
It's extreme.
It is extreme. It is extreme. So
I haven't got it yet, but I'm going to.
Okay, what are you going to get, Emily?
I'm going to get some spandex shorts.
Yeah.
You know, some kind of a wife beater t-shirt.
I don't think you're allowed to say that anymore.
You're not?
Emily, I really don't think so.
Oh,
you're going to be one of those people. This is what I have a problem with, because I have a problem with some bicyclists, too, who, especially if you're going to be on the Charles, where I ran for years and years, and cyclists don't care about the runners.
No, I do.
They will run you off the road.
No.
So
and
you promised me.
And I'm going to get a bell.
And have you memorized your signals yet?
Do I need to know other than put your hand out?
This one.
You guys can't
see
me.
She's gesturing up
and down. Yeah. Why is it? I mean, I get if you're in the Tour de France
or if you're in a
Pan Mass Challenge. Well, you need a helmet in the Pan Mass Challenge. Or if you're like biking like 30 miles on the weekend, you need to get one of these snazzy outfits. But why do you have to? If you go to the bike stores and you notice that the bike pants for the men, they really can stand up by themselves. And you know why that is.
You need some padding, right?
You need some padding. Yeah. But supposedly there's a sperm count issue.
Yeah.
If you bike too much, the sperm count is lower. So you have to be very careful.
Exactly. I bought a new seat, too, that has much better padding on it. Because the seat that came with the bike, forget it.
But why do you need these to be outfitted head to toe?
It's not a question of need.
If you're only going 2 miles to work in the morning.
It's not a question of need.
Okay, what is it, Emily?
I mean, it's like when you go skiing. You got to be right to the nines. You know, there's no point of going skiing unless you're going to have the outfit.
Okay. Now we get to the moment that, of course, we all have been waiting for from week to week to week with bated breath.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter.
I have absolutely no interest.
Hold on for a second.
Jared hasn't gotten
Hold on
to do
for
this
a second.
Yet.
I was going to say, Jared, you're not usually here. It's usually, of course, Jim Browdy. What do you make of that intro? Is not that one of the greatest intros of all time?
Marjorie, I'm having post-traumatic stress disorder because that encapsulates the last 15 years of my life, which is exactly how long I've known Emily Rooney.
Okay, there you go. Do you have a theme today?
I do. I do have a theme. And actually, this is a theme that was inspired, coincidentally, by Jared Bowen.
Oh, God, we can't wait.
So my theme this week is words I cannot pronounce.
Ooh.
Oh.
So
for me, that's almost every word.
Here's what happened. I'm on the set on Greater Boston, and every week or twice a week, Jared is on, and the copy reads WGBH Arts Editor Jared Bowen. So I said, I can't say it. I can't say WGBH Arts. There's something about So we had to add news, WGBH News Arts Editor, and then I could say it.
I was wondering how that happened.
That's why, because I couldn't say it, and I was stumbling all over. And then it got me to thinking about other words I just cannot say, and especially if I'm reading a track or I'm saying it quickly, it doesn't come out right. Homeland. I can't say it.
Wait a minute. What'd you say?
When I really think about it, I can do it. I always come out homeland.
I can say that. It's fascinating how people.
There's different words that really trip me up.
Arbitrary words.
When I'm reading a script, I have to change this word because I can't say it when I'm reading it as advocacy.
Advocacy.
You're doing well, Marjorie.
She just said advocacy.
I have a trick.
You did, yeah.
Advocacy. I have a trick, and I'm going to tell you when you're done what my trick is.
Now, so that got me to sort of asking people what other words they have hard times with. And I was Kathy, or camera gal, was in the studio, and she says she can't say showering. When you start really focusing on these things. All right. Now, I think you came up with this one, Jared.
I know what it is.
Particularly.
I can't. In years,
that's
I,
hard.
Particularly. You see, I can't.
It's hard.
Years ago, John Carroll had to say to me, just write especially.
Just
always say
that
especially
word.
Instead.
Okay.
And then, all right, so somebody else in the studio couldn't say ambulance.
My dad can't say that one.
Ambulance. What does he say?
He says ambulance.
Yeah, there you go.
Now,
ambulance.
This is a problematic situation for someone whose job is involved talking and pronouncing.
Yeah, but I've only got a few, and I try to avoid
okay.
the ones
you
that
avoid
I can't.
The ones.
So these are
okay.
I've expanded the list to include words that mm-hmm. other people tell me they can't say. Statistics.
That was mine. I can't say that. It was statistics.
Yeah, see?
I
okay.
can't say it.
Inhabitants, same thing.
Mm-hmm. What else?
Compartmentalized.
That's a hard one.
And then the classic George W. Bush, nuclear.
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 Nuclear. Yeah, he always said that wrong.
Yeah.
Can you say poignant?
I hate that word, poignant.
Poignant. I think I say it wrong. Poignant.
How do you say it?
Jim is always telling me I'm saying it wrong. I thought I was saying it right, but he always tells me I'm wrong. Poignant.
All right, so then they stopped down tape the other day on me. V-E-H-E-M-E-N-T.
Vehement.
I would say vehement. Vehement.
I would not pronounce the H. You know, here's the thing. I have to tell
That's
you.
It's like vehicular.
I am probably one of the few talk show hosts in America who spent as much time at a speech coach as I have. And what I learned at the speech coach is that you're supposed to open your mouth very, very wide. You're supposed to do exercises like ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta- Well, if you do, that helps you to pronounce things and not run your letters together. But it's really hard. Look at the way I look when I'm talking. We should have the camera in here. You look ridiculous, so you don't do it. Ridiculous. That's one people mispronounce all the time. They say, or anyway, that's what you have to do. You have to talk with your mouth really wide open, Emily, but you look silly doing it.
So, I will work on that. Okay. Oh, here's another one. Right. Singularly. That's a tough one, too.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. Singularly.
Am I allowed to chime in? Can I tell you what drives me crazy? Our former president, Bill, and his wife, Hillary, they don't know how to pronounce her last name.
You're kidding.
Well, what do they say? How do you pronounce it?
Clinton.
You just said it. See, Emily said you. That's what does
Clinton.
It. Yeah, Clinton. Yeah. It's Clinton.
Oh, Clinton.
That's what Marjorie said. Clinton.
I don't
just
think
like,
it is.
Like Huntington and Mountain.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Clinton.
If you know, people say their last, I always say, oh, you're saying your last name wrong. You know, they change the way. You know,
I think you need to. I think you need to do your voice exercises, Emily. I think you need to stand in the mirror and open your mouth really wide, and then you'll be able to talk.
Or you go to Emerson College, where you have voice and articulation classes.
Did you learn it there?
I did. Okay. Nancy Hands the Man the Dandy Candy.
That's, I think my voice is pretty good.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plane.
We're talking about
words. All
right,
do you have any more words?
That's it?
Okay, have you anything else to complain
Compartmentalized.
About? Compartmentalized. That's what Bill Clinton did with his life, correct? Anything else?
I'm done.
Can you say espresso?
Especially espresso.
Okay, some people say espresso. I was wrong about that too.
That's true.
It's espresso. Okay, Emily Rooney joins us every Friday for Open Mic. And of course, you can keep up with her weeknights at 7 o'clock on Channel 2 for Greater Boston. Emily, as always,
Marjorie,
thank you for being
with
us.
Good to see you, Jared.
Compartmentalize.
Up next, it's our Friday news quiz. It's No Holds Barred as two Shakespeare experts duel over news quiz supremacy. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
If you already support 89.7 WGBH, there may be a way to double or even triple your contribution without spending another dime. Thousands of New England employers have matching gift programs. Ask at work if yours is one of them. More information online at wgbh.org/matchinggifts.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, bringing diverse people to Boston. The series returns to Symphony Hall next season with Dan Rather, Madeline Albright, Ken Burns, and others. BostonSpeakerSeries.org. And the communities of Orchard Cove and Newbridge on the Charles, offering you the information you and your parents need to make the right decision about senior living. You can check out the guide at hslindependentliving.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. It is time for our Friday news quiz. William Shakespeare's 450th birthday was a couple of weeks ago. We're throwing him a belated, and posthumous birthday party with Alan Burrows, Artistic Director of Actors Shakespeare Project, and Stephen Mailer, Artistic Director of Commonwealth Shakespeare Company. Mailer?
You got it.
Okay, just want to make sure. Thank you so much for being here. So, you're going to tell us and our listeners too what this is about. Let's start with Alan. What is the Actors Shakespeare Project, please?
Well, we perform shows all over the city. This last year, we did four productions. We started out at the Strand Theater down in Dorchester. And then we just ended up with a production of As You Like It in Medford. So
terrific.
We don't just do Shakespeare. Occasionally, we'll do things like Chekhov. We did a production of Cherry Orchard out at Pine Manor College this spring. And then next year, we're gearing up for another exciting season. We've almost gotten entirely through the canon. We're doing Comedy of Errors to start, and then we're going to move on to Racine's Phaedra, directed by Bevan O'Gara. David Gammons will direct Comedy of Errors, and then Measure for Measure, directed by Megan Sandberg-Zakian. And then Tommy Dara, who you may know as an actor around town, is going to direct an unusual play by Jenny Schwartz called God's Ear. And then Tina Packer, formerly of Shakespeare and Company, will come back and will direct our Henry VI Part 2.
Wow. So how many plays are you talking about in a single year?
We do five productions a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And how
do
you figure out what you're going to do to balance out Shakespeare, the non-Shakespeare pieces?
We let whatever bubbles up within the company membership kind of decide and see how it would balance. We're language-based. We're all about an intimate relationship with the audience. And so we kind of bounce a lot of ideas around. And if it's language-based and intimate and impactful, then we figure it can make the grade.
Okay, Stephen, give us a spiel on the Commonwealth Shakespeare Company.
Sure, sure.
I saw a lovely picture of you with Kerry Healy, the president of Babson College.
Yes, we're now in residence out at Babson College, which we're really thrilled about. CSC is most known for its flagship production, which is Shakespeare in the Park. We do an annual free production of Shakespeare every summer on the Boston Common, which is not very intimate. We have about 10,000 people on a good Saturday night on the Boston Common seeing free productions of Shakespeare. And that's really the main thing that we do. But we're also building out our season now with the residency at Babson and hope to be doing indoor productions throughout the year as well out in Wellesley.
There was a questioning in the piece I read in the Globe, why Babson? Because we think of Babson as a business school.
And it's a really interesting question. And, you know, what I would say is that Babson is not your typical business school. Babson is extremely passionate and focused on entrepreneurship, which is about creation. So the notion of creativity and arts and business and entrepreneurship is actually much more synergistic than one might feel at first blush.
You ready for the quiz? Oh, go ahead, Jared, before we get to the quiz.
We haven't even talked about it. So what's your big production this summer?
Oh, so this summer we're doing Twelfth Night.
Neat.
Shakespeare's, I think, best comedy and arguably one of his best plays. We've actually done it before, but it was quite some time ago. So we're revisiting this play and really, really excited about it. We've got an amazing cast, beautiful designs, terrific design team, and we start rehearsals in about 3 weeks.
Wow, which is good. You're always the harbinger of summer when we start reading about you. That's nice. We enjoy that.
I always feel so terrible when they get rained out. A couple of times you've rained out last year, I think, right?
I know. The worst year was the year we did The Tempest. So there's note to self.
Fitting.
Don't do The Tempest outside.
Okay. So you guys ready to go?
Sure.
Do you want to go, you two here, us two there, and then we'll switch over?
Okay, because
okay?
This is my own first time doing the news,
news
quiz, but I get to preside.
You
so
get to preside.
I'm
that's
not
correct.
Nervous.
Okay. You ready to go?
Okay.
Okay, go ahead, Jared.
All right. Someone's prom invite made national headlines this week. Here's a clip from a recent newscast.
A bold high school student from Connecticut had a big dream for her prom. She wanted to go with what she called the most delightful man in America. Who was that in her estimation? Talia Maselli actually wrote a note to the asking him to be her date. She wasn't expecting a response, so she was shocked on the eve of her prom to get this, a handwritten note from said he couldn't come because of his busy schedule, but he wrote to her and said, I hope you will accept this corsage and enjoy your prom as much as I did mine.
All right, Steve Mailer, who did this bold high school student invite to the prom?
That would be Ryan Gosling.
Oh. No. That is not
That's
true.
A great guess.
See, I thought if I just tried to be
guess.
Bold and like committed, that I would get away with it.
That would be. Can you imagine everybody going gaga with Ryan Gosling? Do you have any idea over there, Alan?
Vice President Joe Biden.
You are correct.
Ah, excellent. I would prefer Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, me too. Although I heard his new movie's terrible.
I know. I heard that too.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Well, you have to kick to the curb.
I guess so. Okay, you ready, Alan? This is your turn. You get a point for the last one, though, too, because you got the Joe Biden thing right. Okay, here is Conan O'Brien weighing in on a big headline from the week.
Today, ladies and gentlemen, became legal in Oregon. Even more amazing, in Portland, it's mandatory. You can't get your driver's license.
Yeah, I can't get...
Okay, Alan, what was legalized in Oregon?
Gay marriage.
You are correct. That's very good. It's like sweeping the country now. Every time you open the newspaper someplace else, gay marriage is getting...
Just two this week. It was Oregon and then Pennsylvania the next day.
That's right. Yeah, Pennsylvania. Yes.
About time.
Okay, I'm going to ask you the most cliched question about Shakespeare that you should have been asked a million times, but because it's fascinating. How much of Shakespeare was hand? Did he write? How much of it did you think he wrote?
Marjorie's a conspiracy theorist. I had no idea.
Yeah, well, you just always hear this story, and you've spent your life involved with the bard. What do you think?
Well, I mean, to me, it's actually kind of a moot point, because the reality is these amazing plays exist, and somebody wrote them. I actually think one person wrote them. I think that Shakespeare wrote them. I think that they're clearly plays like Pericles, which Alan's company just did, and I did way back when I was a kid at the ART, is a mess of a play, and Shakespeare wrote some of it, but certainly not all of it. But the plays exist, and one of the great things about doing Shakespeare is, I say to the company of actors that we assemble, you know who the genius in the room is when you're doing Shakespeare, and it's not you. So some genius put all of these words together, and we are incredibly lucky that we have them here to work on.
So you think it's one genius and some plays are a mix?
I think so.
Is that what you think too, Alan?
Almost, yeah.
Okay.
I'm in an agreement with that almost all the way, except for when you bring up certain writers like Fletcher and Middleton and people who may or may not have been his apprentices along the way. I think he had a hand in everything. I think he farmed some stuff out. I don't think that they had so much ownership over the material as we do today. And as a result, they were collaborations all over the place. But I would concur with Steve that he was definitely, if not penning it out, definitely right there involved.
Okay. Yeah. I love that. I like that answer very much. Mm-hmm. I don't like to hear the other things. You ready to go? Mm-hmm. Ready for the next question?
Okay, Steve Mailer. Listen to a little bit of the song Taurus by the band Spirit and tell us why this little-known song from 1968 is in the news this week. Okay, so Steve Mailer, why is that song Taurus written way back in 1968? Why is that song by Spirit making news this week?
Because it's being alleged now to be plagiarized by Led Zeppelin for Stairway to Heaven.
Yay,
where's
recovery.
The ding, ding, ding?
It was faint.
There we go. Okay, thank you.
It does sound like Stairway to Heaven.
Stairway to Heaven?
Is there not a statute of limitations for, you go back to 1968? Apparently not, if they're bringing us into...
I don't remember ever slow dancing to Taurus.
No. When did Stairway to Heaven come out? In the early 70s?
72.
So not... 71. Thank you very much. That was our crack production staff, Chelsea, and they told us that. So 3 years after. Yeah. Does this ruin people's...
Well, this harkens back to the Shakespeare question, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we have the music, and obviously Led Zeppelin made a lot of money on Stairway to Heaven in a way that Shakespeare wouldn't have, but... you pick stuff up out of the ether as well.
Yeah.
That seems a little too specific to have picked it up out of the ether.
Well, isn't it fascinating, too, that we can keep having new? I mean, you would think that at this point...
All the combinations.
Yeah, everything has been done. How can we possibly have something new?
Okay. Is it your turn, Alan?
That's up to you.
Okay. I forget where we were.
It is Alan's turn.
Okay, it's Alan's turn. I'm getting confused. Okay, here we go, Alan. This week, a TV game show personality fired off tweets that irked a lot of environmentalist types. Here's Conan O'Brien.
Wheel of Fortune host is in the news. Yep. Posted several tweets mocking people who believe in global warming. Yeah. The tweet was hard to understand because didn't buy any vowels.
Okay. Do you know what game show host sent out the controversial tweets?
Wheel of Fortune host.
You are right.
Well, we need the name.
I'm stalling.
I would help you, but I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, it certainly isn't Pat Sajak.
Pat Sajak.
What I did there?
That's correct. And here's what he tweeted. He said, "Global warming alarmists are unpatriotic racists, knowingly misleading for their own ends." Racists? I don't know how he got there.
Well, he also came out as being straight fairly recently, too.
What? Really? Are you seriously?
No, this is real. This is true.
Was there?
He came out as being a heterosexual.
Okay. So he just announced, "I'm straight."
Yes, I think he likes to be incendiary.
Yeah, I guess he does.
Well, you have to stay relevant. I mean, that show's been on the air since 1902.
Right. I know. How's that? What's her name? Who's the woman that does it?
Vanna White.
She's still there.
She's holding up well.
Wow.
I mean, there's architecture involved. There's scaffolding involved.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. Whatever it takes, I guess, with Vanna White. Okay. Go ahead, Jared.
All right, Steve, what do these disparate words have in common? Fangirl, turducken, youper.
Can you say the words again?
I will repeat the words. Fangirl, turducken, and youper.
I'm going to guess they were all added to the dictionary recently.
That is correct.
Very good. You guys are really something. This is fantastic.
More specifically, the Merriam-Webster dictionary.
That's right.
Oh, I think I would have not quite gotten that right.
Okay. Here we go, Alan. What discovery did an Argentinian farmhand make last weekend? Here's a news clip about it.
Tonight, the bones of a believed to be the largest creature ever to walk the earth. A local farm worker stumbling on the remains. Paleontologists digging them up. Based on that colossal limb, scientists concluding the beast was 65 feet tall and 130 feet long.
Any idea?
It wasn't a statue of Shakespeare.
No, it was not.
And it wasn't a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Didn't they just find Richard III's bones in London? So maybe
under a parking lot, right?
Under a parking lot. Yeah.
So it wasn't Tyrannosaurus Rex then?
No, you're in the right family, but... not it. You want to take a guess?
That's all I would have had.
Okay. A titanosaur. The largest earth-dwelling creature ever discovered.
Yeah, well, we don't even know if they ever existed.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you see the picture? One of the discoverers was lying down, and his whole body was just the length of the femur. This thing was ginormous, and it was a vegetarian, which doesn't make any sense.
Was it named after the Titanic, do you think?
I think that came a little later.
Maybe the other way around.
Yeah. Okay. Vegan dinosaurs.
Okay, now we have the bonus round. Now, the bonus round is very tricky. Nobody ever gets these right, so it's okay if you don't. But here's the premise. Since we're marking Shakespeare's 450th birthday, and his birthplace is Stratford-upon-Avon, we're going to ask you about Avon Cosmetics. And the protocol at this point is we switch. You will ask Alan and I will ask Stephen, okay?
Okay.
You ready to go, Stephen?
I'm ready.
Okay, question one. For Father's Day, and these are multiple choice. For Father's Day, Avon is heavily promoting its fragrances for men. Which of these is a real-life Avon fragrance? A, Animal Instinct for Him. B, Maximum Expression for Him. C, Unplugged for Him. What do you think? Animal Instinct, Maximum Expression, or Unplugged?
I'll go with B.
That is a very good guess.
But not successful, though.
Do you have a particular fondness, Alan, for Avon Cosmetics? Would you like to take a guess on which is the fragrance?
There's no way that it can be called Animal Instinct.
I hope not.
It's got to be unplugged.
Doesn't sound so great either.
Yeah, it is unplugged, but you're right. What does that mean?
Because it's like the whole dad, Jimmy Buffett thing, Margaritaville, this is your dad, you accept him even though he's a geek kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. You do have pretty lustrous skin, Alan. You might be a little bit more well-versed in the Avon catalog than we realize.
I'm descended from the... Titanium Rex.
Okay, go ahead, Jared.
Okay, Steve, which of these is a real... Oh, no, Alan, right?
Sorry. Fire away.
I forgot to shift.
No worries.
Which of these is a real Avon tagline? A, Avon, leave the glamour to us. B, before you call your doctor, call your Avon lady. Or C, with one stroke of lipstick, turn 1,000 heads.
I think it would have... What was the first one?
The first one, Leave the Glamour to Us?
I think it would have to be Leave the Glamour to Us.
Really?
That's a great one, though. They should have used that. Isn't that a great line?
I could see Don Draper delivering this.
Exactly.
I'm going to guess B because I don't want it to be C.
Yeah.
I think C is kind of sexy.
Yeah, B is good, yeah. B is right.
Before you call your doctor, call your Avon lady. That's kind of weird.
Those are words not to live by.
Yeah.
So when you're having a heart infarction, call your...
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess. Have you been to Stratford on Avon?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah?
Yeah. And in the theater there?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How cool is that?
Oh, I went many eons ago. I saw Jeremy Irons do Winter's Tale there. Oh. It was really stunning. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
My favorite thing was I actually got into the library and sort of this vault down below. I don't know if you were able to get in there, but they literally have these incredible books that are under, you know, hermetically sealed, lock and key, and you were able to sort of get into this very high-tech vault and look at some of the original manuscripts. It's pretty amazing.
Well, I was going to ask. I didn't even realize that. Are there actual manuscripts that survive of purportedly of Shakespeare?
Well, I don't know if it's his pen to paper, but...
Right. Well, they have, you know, original versions of the first folio. Yale has them in a vault as well. And you can hold original copies, and that has an immediate resonance.
It's pretty powerful.
It's fairly electric. Yeah.
Now, obviously, everybody always says, you know, Shakespeare, all the human emotions and the brilliant writing and the brilliant characters and all that. But it is sometimes surprising to think that Shakespeare still hangs on, that there's so much of an interest of it. In Shakespeare's plays still.
Absolutely. I mean, look at House of Cards. I mean, Kevin Spacey has just reinvented the Shakespeare canon. I know he was doing Richard III while he was working on and developing that, but I also see a great Macbeth and Lady Macbeth in those two actors.
And Kenneth Branagh is bringing Macbeth back to New York as well.
Absolutely. You know, I'm seeing that in a couple of weeks. It's just be pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, ready for your next question? Oh, I think this goes to Alan. No, Stephen.
Steve.
I'm sorry. No, which of these was a real New York Times headline? A, the Avon Ladies of Africa. B, mid-century feminism from housewife to Avon lady. Or C, Avon Ladies night out.
I'm going to go for B. No, I just am not...
These are hard.
I'm not a product guy. Sorry.
These are hard. Do you have a guess, Alan?
I would say A.
You are correct.
Yeah.
Avon Ladies of Africa.
You know, I think that headline caught my eye at one point. That's why I say that.
We've gone through the questions, right? So we have a winner now. Okay, you're going to announce the scores. Who is the winner at the end of our news quiz, please? Alan, congratulations.
Oh.
You won 5-7.
You get the mug.
Thanks. Yeah. We would give you a mug, but we don't have any. We really should have some prizes.
Isn't there a pile of 3 tenor CDs around here?
Yeah.
A tote bag?
We should have a tote bag, shouldn't we? We need to have some kind of mug. Yeah. Boston Public Radio, but we don't. We only have water glasses. Right. So tell us about when the production starts in Boston Common. When's it going to be?
So we're the last week of July and the first 2 weeks of August. And again, it's 12th night, so go to our website, comshakes.org, and come find out some more information about the production.
And is it free?
It is, in fact.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And what is going on right now in your production world, Alan?
Well, we're gearing up for next season, so people can go to actorsshakespeareproject.org and buy a subscription or line themselves up for next year. We're going to start with Comedy of Errors, directed by David Gammons.
Are you both actors before you became bosses?
I gave that up a long time ago because there were a lot of people like Alan much more skillful than me at that. But I certainly did. I trod a bit on the boards, but I left that behind a long time ago.
And you did.
I did not know well enough to leave it behind. I still do it. Steve directed me in a show about Shakespeare, Robert Brustein's The Last Will, last year. So I played Shakespeare and actually got an interesting insight into the man.
Is there a little pressure to cast you since you're...
Actually, no. I try to shy away from that, actually. That's really scary.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you guys, it was great to come in, and it's so wonderful that Shakespeare is doing so well in 2014.
Absolutely.
It feels like there's a resurgence. It's a resurgence. It's great.
Yeah.
I still have my big, thick, complete works of Shakespeare from college, and it's kind of neat. Oh, we're getting Oh, we're getting prizes. I take it back. Our crack production staff has brought in prizes. Okay, Alan Burrows is artistic director of Actors Shakespeare Group. To learn more about it, as he just said, go to 2014-2015, their calendar. Go to actorsshakespeareproject.org. Stephen Mailer, artistic director of Commonwealth Shakespeare Company. To learn more about what they're doing, go to comshakespeare.org. That's C-O-M-M shakes, whoops, comshakes.org. comshakes.org. Okay, we are almost out of time here, so let me hurry up. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for a Memorial Day special. We'll hear from New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff and also talk food and wine with Corby Kummer and Jonathan Alsop. Our show is a production of WGBA, Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, Alan Mattis. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jared Bowen.
Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Please tune in again on Monday.